Today's podcast and the following message are brought to you by ICMA University. ICMA University offers local government leaders access to a worldwide learning community with leadership development and training programs for every career stage. These programs can help you develop creative solutions to community problems and become a more resilient leader in the face of economic, environmental, societal, or natural disasters. With professional leadership and development through ICMA University, you'll lead the way and thrive in your career. Learn more and explore program offerings at icma.org/university. Welcome to this episode of ICMA's Local Gov Life. I'm your host, Erica White. This season, we're sharing stories of crisis and resilience. From natural disasters to acts of violence, local government leaders are on the front line, responsible for guiding the staff and community through the crisis and its aftermath. These powerful stories are told by the people who lived and led through them. In 2014, the world watched as the deadly Ebola virus struck West Africa with a vengeance, ultimately killing more than 11,000 people. In the fall of that year, the first confirmed case of Ebola outside of Africa surfaced in Dallas, Texas, setting off widespread panic. ICMA member A.C. Gonzalez was city manager of Dallas at the time, and Sana Syed was public information director. Together, they take a look back on how they navigated through the crisis of public fear and share lessons learned from the experience.
One of the things that I want to get on the table is some little bit of medical background about Ebola itself. First of all, Ebola is a gruesome killer virus, no question about it. However, there were some attributes about the virus that actually ended up helping us. One, it's a weak virus, meaning that the virus cannot survive outside a host for very long. It's a heavy virus, and as such, it's not transferred through the air when people are coughing or sneezing. And it's quick to attack its host. Within 21 days of exposure, you will know if you have it. And unfortunately, if you do have it, you are frantically trying to save your life because you will not live very long. Now, these characteristics actually helped us in containing the situation as we were going through it. This challenge really tested our mettle. The critical need to work hand in glove with the federal government, with our state government, the county, school districts, and numerous social service agencies and medical facilities in a moment's notice was daunting. I knew immediately that we had to act fast and put all available resources to bear on the challenge to minimize the damage. What I didn't realize was that there were going to be so many gaps in line authority and just how big getting the message out was going to be. That's why I asked Sana Syed to join me to tell some of the stories which occurred in the hopes of providing some insights on how we can improve our response to the next event. You were the public information officer of Dallas during that time, and it was an unbelievable few weeks that you were right in the middle of getting so much information and, quite frankly, a lot of misinformation from so many places and trying to craft a thoughtful response. This response was something that was needed not only in the community but throughout the country, because indeed, when the story broke, Dallas was the first American city to have Ebola. So any opening thoughts on your part?
Mm-hmm. Ebola really was a situation for us where we were managing the fear and the panic more than Ebola itself. We were trying to manage that panic and that fear through communication, through information, and basically trying to gain the public's trust and allowing them to know that we had a handle on the situation.
So, Sana, why don't you set the stage as to some of the highlights of what happened during that time?
Well, we really can look at this as our three biggest issues being faced with each patient being diagnosed with Ebola. With Thomas Eric Duncan, we were up against identifying everyone that he had come into contact with. He came from a neighborhood, the Ivy Apartments, were 50 languages and dialects were spoken there. Decontaminating that home, finding a temporary home for his girlfriend, Louise Tro, finding a homeless man who we believe had come into contact with him because he also rode in that same ambulance, how to get rid of biohazards. When Nina Pham, the first nurse in the United States, was diagnosed with Ebola. We went again through how do you identify those contacts? How do we reach out to the community? Transferring her to NIH and not contaminating anybody in that process. Putting her dog in isolation. Testing the first dog in the United States for Ebola. And then with the third patient, Amber Vincent, who was also a nurse, again, identifying those contacts, notifying residents, how to execute communicable disease control orders, transporting her to Emory, and addressing healthcare workers who travel in general. So each patient that we dealt with presented different challenges.
And really, Sana, those were really just the highlights, of course, because this whole event ended up impacting tens of thousands of people. I say that number because it was not just the people that were exposed to the disease. There were people that were displaced from their homes. There was medical staffs. There were experts from all over the country and the world that were brought in to bear on the topic. We had four levels of government responding. There was the school district, and there were tens of thousands, if not more, that were just frightened because they didn't know how they were being impacted. Now, we're going to cover about five areas on this topic as we were working through this event. And the first one we want to talk about is just how the breaking of the news to the community and to the world took place. And Sana, why don't you take it from there?
I was actually in a meeting with the fire chief and the city attorney and the fire PIO when the PIO for the fire department said, oh, look, we've got the first case of Ebola in the United States. Well, within 45 minutes, I was in the EOC and just about every key executive in the city. And in the EOC, we had our medical authority at that point trying to explain to everybody really that crash course in Ebola, if you will, and trying to help us all understand what this meant for us, what the real danger was, because we learned within this time frame that it was Dallas Fire Rescue paramedics who had transported patient zero, Thomas Eric Duncan, to Presbyterian Hospital. And at that point, our concern became our paramedics and also everyone who was transported after patient zero. And we were discussing what's the best term to explain it. Better yet, what are we doing with our paramedics? And the media, as you can imagine, it was endless at that point. We were an endless cycle of information for the media for 38 days after this point. The media started showing up. We started granting interviews outside the Emergency Operations Center. One of our fire chiefs who had been in direct contact with the paramedics, he was phenomenal. And we were doing interviews throughout the night and he was letting everyone know, we've got a handle on the situation. Our paramedics are being tested. They are volunteer isolation. We are not forcing them. We're not cutting them off from the world, but they themselves have volunteered to lay low for a few weeks so that we can ensure that they, in fact, do not have Ebola. For the next few days, then, there was quite the panic and the interest. The governor came to Dallas and had a press conference. The CDC was here. This is the day after we had learned that we have the first confirmed case of Ebola. The CDC, they were torn between whose press conference to go. And we were scheduling press conferences at the same time. But what was really interesting with this situation is that as we were learning more and more about Ebola, our children started being pulled out of different schools throughout the Dallas Independent School District. And we had video on the news of parents running with their children in their arms away from the schools and pulling their kids from schools, physically running from the schools with their children in their arms. Let them know how critical it is that you work together on the message. One of the other biggest issues that we had to deal with from a communication standpoint is that that community was a community primarily made up of immigrants. And so those 50 languages and dialects, we were at a complete loss as to how to quickly address that within one day so that we could let these parents and these children know what was going on, because people were starting to show up in hazmat suits for the decontamination process. And Dallas Independent School District and some community groups were instrumental in getting us that help. DISD actually had translators on staff, or they had freelance services available where they were very quickly able to translate a flyer that we had agreed upon And they sent those flyers home with students. And then we went to the apartment complex and we distributed them as well. On top of that, the Dallas County Health and Human Services team also came in behind us and started to distribute some collateral. But those were some of the biggest things. And these were all things that happened within the first 24 hours after we learned that we had the first case of Ebola in the United States.
As Sana mentioned, when we got the word that in fact we had Ebola in the community, I recognize that this is something that we had to have all hands on deck type of response. And as she mentioned, we were all there together to work on it. I'd like to say that we were all together, but in truth, we weren't. We did not have clarity about just who was in charge, who was going to be the decider of what facts were going to be the ones that we were going to be going with. And there was immediately a lot of questions about what was the right thing to be doing as it related to our firefighters, who, even though they acted brilliantly in terms of their working with patient zero, we didn't know exactly what was the best thing to do with regards to letting them come back to work or to what to do with ambulance. We knew, as we said, we had a national story on our hands. It was an international traveler. It was a new disease into the community. There was so much interest in the story itself. And just the question about whether or not who is going to be taking charge and taking liability for what might be happening was a question that we immediately had. Expertise. You would think that immediately the CDC would be the ones that would give us all the correct information. We found that really, as much as anything else, they were a monitor, they were a resource, but it was left up to the state, to our local medical society, and others like Doctors Without Borders who weighed into giving us advice about various aspects. There was also logistical issues about what do you do with contaminated debris? How do you control the scene in terms of what is the extent of the control of the scene where the patient zero and his family was at? How much of that do you cordon off? Who's going to actually issue these communicable disease control orders and who's going to take responsibility for those people that might be quarantined against their wishes? So there was a number of things that when you started to get down to who exactly was going to be giving orders at that time, we realized that while in a natural disaster, we have a lot of that worked out as it relates to earthquakes, tornadoes, etc. But in terms of a medical emergency, it was not as clear. Now, out of that, we also had some interesting unintended consequences. One had to do with a dog, of all things. And Sana, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, when we learned that Nina Pham had a dog in that apartment, that dog had to be tested for Ebola. We immediately thought about the nurse in Spain, and her dog was euthanized. We decided no matter what happens, we will allow the time for this dog to be properly monitored for Ebola, and we had zero intention of euthanizing that dog. And furthermore, we were going to take the guidance of vets that we were assigned from the state. We were going to take their direction on how to proceed if Bentley was in fact diagnosed with Ebola. Well, this whole process became quite a task because, as you can imagine, there has never been a dog at this point that has ever been tested for Ebola anywhere in this country. We were having these conversations with the state, with state vet authorities on how to do this and to not traumatize the dog and to safely do this where you're not putting other people in danger in case the dog does in fact have Ebola. One of the concerns became, well, where is this dog going to stay for 3 weeks while this monitoring process is happening? Well, we had a decommissioned Air Force base that the city owned, Hensley Field, and there was an old building there that wasn't being used, and we kept Bentley in a nice little room in that house. We had our equipment and building services department go in, and they prepared that space. They brought in the crates. They brought in everything that we could as a city to prepare that space so that Bentley could be monitored for the next few weeks. Texas A&M, they sent their top vets, and the care with which this animal was taken care of over those few weeks, and just the sheer amount of attention these vets paid to Bentley. I was tasked with monitoring Bentley as well, because what was happening was this was Nina Pham's dog, and I was not comfortable telling the world the status of her dog without her knowing. Here she is thinking she's dying. She's now been transported to NIH. So every single day, the world was asking for an update on Bentley. Everyone wanted to make sure Bentley was okay. And every day I was providing an update, but I would talk to someone in Nina's family first. Well, when Nina started to feel better, I would tell her, this is how Bentley's doing. These are some of the cute things he did. These are his pictures. Are you okay with me sharing this with media? And she would say, yes, on this information. I would like for this information to be kept private. And I would honor that, because at the end of the day, this is basically in her eyes, her child. And we were trying to be very respectful of the fact that she was even allowing us to share this story. So that was the long and short of Bentley. There's much more to say about that, because we also then had to plan a reunion for Bentley and Nina, which also became an international event.
Senna has gone over the soft side about the dog situation. I was having to deal with some of the harder sides, like who's going to be paying for all of this care. And I can assure you it was not inexpensive. Anyway, that was another aspect of that story that proved to be something that you wouldn't necessarily be thinking about. Another was how to get shelter to those that were immediately exposed to Ebola and were needing another place to stay. We found that, again, the fear was so pervasive and so extraordinary that people were refusing to rent them any sort of shelter. And it was getting down to even some of family members of city officials were looking to offer up their properties in order to provide that shelter. It was the Catholic Church, its archdiocese offices, and a former city manager, Bill Keffler, who really helped address that issue and really was greatly appreciated by those of us who were trying to deal with all the various things that were going on. The humanitarian effort was something that was very much appreciated. Now, Sana has already gone over some of the communication challenges, but there was also things that, if you will, technology vehicles that were being used to get the word out. And so just a few words about some of those efforts that were being taken.
With every different patient that we had, we were learning that we had to approach with a different way of communicating. For Thomas Eric Duncan, it was the different languages that we were up against. And fortunately, with the help of DISD and the community partners, we were able to quickly translate those and get the word out. But what happened was, as the nurses started to get diagnosed, we changed our strategy, because we realized every time a nurse was diagnosed, things were about to get real for that neighborhood, which meant that they were going to start seeing people in hazmat suits. The media was going to descend upon those neighborhoods, and we didn't want those neighbors to panic and think that they were in danger. When Nina Pham was diagnosed with Ebola, and we got the confirmation late on a Saturday night, we all got on a conference call, and we decided that I would head off a team with police officers and some firefighters, and the Emergency Operations Center identified a perimeter, and within this short, small area, we were going to go door to door at 3 o'clock in the morning, let people know that someone in their neighborhood had been diagnosed with Ebola, let them know that they were going to see people in hazmat suits, that the media was going to show up soon, and that they had nothing to worry about. And we gave them a fact sheet on Ebola. all of this happened throughout that night and knocked door to door and let everyone that we could let know what was going on. And I remember still that first press conference we had after Nina Pham was diagnosed, the mayor disclosed the location. Soon as that press conference was done, I hightailed it back to that neighborhood. Most of the media had already beat me there. And sure enough, they went door to door and they were camped out there for days. So the door to door thing became huge for us. Having some kind of a fact sheet that we could quickly give people became huge for us. Consistently pushing out information to media, because you have to feed the beast throughout this whole process. When you start withholding information from media, especially for absolutely no reason, they will turn on you. But the more you give them that information and you play ball with them, A, the more forgiving they are if you mess up. B, the more forgiving the public is if you mess up. We developed a script for our 311 call center so that if they started receiving calls from the community, that they knew what to do. We were doing broadcast segments ourselves because we had a broadcast team. We provided raw video of anything that the media was unable to get access to because for whatever reason, officials, apartment complex owners, whatever, didn't want media on property. We would still shoot raw video of what was okay to share with the public and provide that to media so that they had something. We scheduled press conferences, interviews, and did as much public release of information as we could. A little late that I really wish that we had done earlier, we brought every major stakeholder to the table, from the county to the school district, you name it, a medical authority of Dallas County. Everyone came into a room together and we said, how can we create an educational campaign to educate the public about what Ebola is to help quell some of this panic? And we came up with something called No Ebola, K-N-O-W, Ebola. And this campaign, we created collateral with medical experts that explained what Ebola was. And we created posters and rat cards and all sorts of collateral that you could actually go to our website and print off. If you're in a part of a church group, a faith group, you're part of a community group and you want access to this material, you were able to go to our website and print all of it off. We got kiosks, billboards, we'd push ads about this. It was a tremendous effort from all of our stakeholders. So these are just a few of the things that we were working on, the different communication tools we found ourselves using to communicate what was going on.
A lot of what these last comments that Sun is making speaks to why a lot of these, the chain of command, the actual products, the vehicles that were put together on the fly, are things that are better done if they're done in advance of a situation like this, and why we're trying to point this out so that you all can be better prepared to respond to when you or if you have the kind of situation that we had with regards to some disease that has the potential of doing the harm that Ebola can do. But there was other aspects of what we were trying to deal with the situation that followed long after the event, and that was trying to make some changes in state law as to what the alignment is of authority in handling these situations and how it might be better coordinated between the feds, the state, and our local governmental units. I gave a speech to Texas city managers at one of the annual conferences, and the TCMA took it on themselves to see about putting information together. We had Mike Land, who is currently a city manager in Coppell, who took the challenge to see about assembling a team and getting information together. All of this was very good and very helpful to our local governments. But the part of it that we were hoping to see in the way of state law changes that would be helpful in getting clarity did not come to pass. We had some local changes in our arrangements between the county and the city done here in Dallas. But there's really more legislation that would be helpful to get done. There's still a lack, I believe, in terms of guidance on what should be the restrictions on healthcare providers as they travel after being possibly exposed to a disease like Ebola. Whether or not they're clinically in any danger of contracting the disease or not, the public thinks that they're possible carriers. And as such, believe that them traveling are just spreading the disease throughout the country. country. There's questions of whether or not there's better tracking technology that could be used to help out in a situation like what we were dealing with, as well as where are the liabilities with regards to who pays for the many different things that we were talking about throughout this podcast. None of it was inexpensive. And when you start asking yourselves the question of liability, that's something that really needs to be carefully looked at so that we all know that we can put the right resources to make sure that a disease like this would not be something that would be spreading throughout the country. While this specific event was uncharted, it was similar to others we faced, like a natural disaster, major fires, or the ones that we created in tabletop exercises. Those other experiences are absolutely critical in learning not only what everyone is supposed to do, but who is going to be working with you. In a time like this, when all the answers were not apparent, those relationships are critical. Now, while not a part of our disaster preparedness training, we had the good fortune of a local civic group hosting monthly meetings with the chief executive officers of the 7 major public institutions of the city, including the school district, county, hospital, etc. While we discussed community challenges of one kind or another, seeking ways for us to help each other, the real value was that we formed strong relationships. During this and other extreme events, we wouldn't hesitate a second to call on each other, knowing what to expect and being able to immediately get to the needs of the moment. Given the many unknowns, lack of clarity, and fear, I thought it even more important to stay calmly focused, to create moments for us to take a breath, get information from as many perspectives as possible, which most of the time meant that we would have 30 people in a room, and then act with a clear sense of institutional urgency. Mayor Council leadership was also very important. The public is looking to them to interpret the situation and to provide comfort that things are being handled. We worked hard to make sure our policymakers had good information, and sometimes that meant information being delivered hourly and a balanced sense of limitations. The staff leadership team was quickly focused on the response, but with an organization of around 12,000 individuals, there were many, many who were frightened, knowing that they needed to be part of a calm response and also represented an opportunity to get the word out into the community. We quickly organized many town hall meetings for any one of the staff to attend and learn firsthand from doctors the realities and the myths of Ebola. They responded admirably.
We can all rest assured, unfortunately, that in this era of global travel, any disease that is out there throughout the world is a possible visitor to your community. And that is the reality in which we live in, and we need to be better prepared.
That's our show for today. Share your thoughts about the episode by leaving a comment at icma.org/podcasts. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating. Also, please share on social media and tell a friend about us. This episode was sponsored by ICMA University. Thanks for listening to this episode of ICMA's Local Gov Life.